Today in part 5 of our series entitled Dark Clouds, Silver Linings, we examine the silver lining of fear. What is the basis of fear in your life? Is it loss of control? A lack of understanding of what is truly important? Unanswered questions regarding life's real treasures? The continued need for more blessings? How do we gain inner peace? Here's Pastor Seth.
There was a little boy who was at home with his mother. It was about 9:30 at night, and she was cleaning up the kitchen. She said to her son, "Would you go out on the back porch and get me the broom?" And he was looked out on the back porch, and he noticed it was awfully dark out there. And he said, "Mom, do I have to go out? Because it's so dark out there. I'm afraid of the dark." And she said, "Well," and she saw an opportunity, as moms do. She said, "You know, son, listen. If you go out there, Jesus will be with you. He's with you wherever you go." He thought about that a little bit, but he wasn't quite convinced. She said, "You just need to go and call out to him, and he'll be with you." Okay. So with a little bit of courage, he walked over towards the back door, and when he got to the back door, he cracked it open, and he looked out at all that immense darkness outside, and he lost all of his courage, and fear overtook him. And he stood there at the back door, just a little crack, and he peeked his head out and he said, "Jesus, if you're out there, would you hand me the broom?" Now, when I heard that story, I thought, that's us. That's a metaphor of life. There are parts where there's darkness in our life, and we are scared to death to step out into the darkness. And the idea of Jesus being with us may be okay for our, we may be able to get our heads to wrap around that, but still stepping out into the darkness against our fear is something that's really, really hard for us to do. We have been doing a series called Dark Clouds and Silver Linings. I've almost wanted to name this series something different, Lights on a Dashboard. Because the things that we've looked at so far, loneliness, emptiness, and discouragement, depression, today we'll look at fear, next week anger, the following week failure. All of those things, as Christians, we tend to look at as a problem to be solved. Well, sort of. But what these things really are, more so, are like lights on a dashboard that alert us, that tell us there's something under the hood of our car, our heart, that is moving us in wrong directions. And the problem is not just my fear or anger or depression. I have a worse problem than that, that these things point to. They're like lights on the dashboard. So the first 3 weeks we looked at loneliness, emptiness, and discouragement. And I think of these things as the Ecclesiastes experience. We spent 3 weeks looking at Solomon. Solomon tried everything he knew of, everything at his disposal, to somehow fill the empty parts of himself. And what he realized, that no matter what he tried, no matter how many resources he threw at it, that he could not solve the problem of loneliness, emptiness, or discouragement. Now, the silver lining of all of those is this. They point us to two things. That no matter what I try on this side, no matter what glasses I try, the people or events or experiences, and no matter what cards I try to play into any of these, nothing will do for me what my heart hungers for and longs for. I desire something more than what this world can offer, and I desire something more even than everything this world has to offer can do. That's the first silver lining of loneliness, emptiness, and discouragement. But there's a second, and that only God can meet my deepest needs. My deepest needs for connection, with loneliness, my deepest needs for filling and for contentment as opposed to emptiness and encouragement, whereas these things inevitably bring, even the best of them bring discouragement. For most of us as Christians, we came to Christ partly because we already tried everything the world had to offer and it didn't work, and we thought, I think the Christians are onto something. But then as Christians, we do a strange thing. We sort of know this is true, but there's in our fallen human nature, we sort of go back over here just thinking, well now I'm going to be a little bit smarter about marriage and about raising kids and about my job and about how I spend my money. we sort of assume that now that I'm going to be smarter about this, I can get these things to work. Now, that's the Ecclesiastes experience. It's my opinion that God takes all of us through our own version of this, the Ecclesiastes experience. There are silver linings in all of those. Then we started last week with what I think of as the Job experience, which is different. Last week we looked at depression. We're going to look at fear today. Next week we're going to look at anger. What is anger? I mean, what is fear? Fear is fuel. Let's go ahead and go into our next slide. Fear is fueled by a priority belief that I may not get. Now, it's that phrase that's the most important phrase. I may get or I may not get. It's uncertain. Now, I may get or I may not get the life or the feelings or the emotions or the fulfillment I believe I need and deserve in order to be happy. Now, there are about 6 different things in there that are all screwed up. But we don't know that. We just assume that that it's okay to have a priority belief that that I should have the life that I want and that I need. I get to define what I need and I deserve, and the highest priority in life is to be happy. All of those things are firmly in place in our fallen human nature. And it takes an act of God over a lifetime with a sledgehammer to chip away and bust away this rock, this machine that lies within us. Now, what fear does is it alerts us that this is here. We would never see this without fear. Now, we looked at Job last week. If you missed last week, Job lost 7 sons and 3 daughters. He lost 7, all of his kids. He lost 7,000 sheep, all of his sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 oxen, 500 donkeys. In other words, he not only lost all of his kids, he was wiped out. He was ready to file chapter 11. In Job 1 and 2, he responds pretty well. But in Job 3, the reality of everything he's lost starts to come crashing in on him. Job 3:25. He says, "What I feared has come upon me. What I dreaded has happened to me." Now, what I think he's saying is something like this. What I feared is that all these things over here that I thought would make life work may not work. That's fear. Now, what dread is fear on steroids. If fear means I may not get the life that I want, the feeling good and fulfillment I want, what dread is a sense that it's not just that I'm not going to get what I want, but it's going to feel like death. That's what dread is. Now, he has experienced both of these by the time he gets to this part in Job chapter 3. Verse 26, here are the effects of this. I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest, but only turmoil. Now, he's not talking about his outside world. He's talking about his inside world. Things like, I go to sleep, I turn out the lights at night, I put my head on the pillow, and my eyes are wide open. My mind is spinning around, thought after thought after thought. What am I going to do? What's my future look like? He wakes up in the morning before the alarm clock goes off, and he wonders, he looks at the ceiling, and he thinks, what am I going to do? What does my life look at? Where am I going to go from here? And his fear is that life may not work like he thought it was going to. The light on the dashboard is blinking, but it points not to a problem to be solved, fear, but a belief that this life and the things of this life ought to work like they should, and that I have made this pursuit central in my life. This is the Job experience. And I am foolish to make this the central purpose of my life. Fear. Life may not work like I think it should. Now, the second aspect of fear is a loss of perceived control. All of us like to believe, without thinking it, that there's a certain amount of control that we have, and we live with an illusion of a certain amount of control, controlling the people and events in our life to bring us what we think we need and to protect us from wrong. And as long as we're in control so we think, then we keep sort of fear at a distance. Now, is that how fear really works? It seems like it does, but that's not how fear works. In chapter 1, if you were here last week, Satan comes to God and he says, you know, the only reason Job loves you and serves you is because of all the goodies you provide him. You give him all these great things. Who wouldn't love you? Love you. And you protect him from harm. You put a hedge around him. Who wouldn't love you? But take away that hedge of protection and take away his goodies. And let's see what Job does. Now, it's my belief that all of us are sort of like Job. That's true, what Satan accused Job of. And that's true at the deepest levels in our heart, though we're not aware of it. I'll follow God as long as the following conditions are met. We all have our little list there in our heart. We may not be able to identify what those items are, but they're there. And the reason we know they're there is fear. Fear points us to something deeper. Now, in Job 21, Job says, when I think about this, I am terrified. Trembling seizes my body. Now, what causes terror in his heart? What causes him to tremble? He tells us. Why do the wicked live on, growing old and increasing in power? They see their children established around them, their offspring before their eyes. He says, I don't get that. I've been trying to be a godly man and doing what God tells me to do, and I'm suffering. And I look at these godless people out there, and it seems like life is just one merry stream for them. This is very confusing for Job. 9, their homes are safe and free from fear. Or so it seems. The rod of God is not upon them, or so it seems. Their bulls never fail to breed. Their cows calve and do not miscarry. They send forth their children as a flock. Their little ones dance about. They sing to the music of tambourine and harp. They make merry to the sound of the flute. They spend their years in prosperity and go down to the grave in peace. Yet they say to God, leave us alone. We have no desire to know your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? What would we gain by praying to him? Now, Job is confused about this because what he's assumed is that if he's in control of his situation, if he does what he's supposed to do, then God is obligated to give him the goodies that he wants. And what he sees here is that he's not in control. He could not get about the goodies that he wanted to continue on. And these people who have nothing to do with God, don't care to be relate to God at all, how come they have all these goodies? Now, what is he afraid of? What he's afraid of is, do I really live in a world where I cannot control the things that are most important to me? That's what he realizes here. And this just throws him into a tailspin. Because up until this time, he believed that he could control what was going on around him. If he just did what was right, then God would do what was right. Now, again, included here, go ahead to verse 6. This is what brings terror to him. When I think about this, I am terrified. Trembling seizes my body. Now, 10 verses later, past the verses we just read, he says, he realizes that their prosperity of the ungodly is not in their hands. Now, what he's saying is this. For 10 verses, he's saying, I look at the godless people and what they're getting, and I take snapshots of that. And every snapshot I take looks to be a happy picture. But now what he sees is, he realizes he's just taking temporary pictures. This is not going to be the final destiny of everyone, that there's a DVD that he really needs to look at. And what he realizes is that though the wicked may look like they're on easy street now, but their prosperity is not in their own hands, meaning they're not in control either. It may seem to them like they're in control, but they're not in control, and neither am I. That is the world that I live in. Now, control is an awful taskmaster. Because on one hand, what we fear the most is the loss of control. What happens if I don't have control over any of the things that are important to me? That's like Job strikes terror in you, if you're aware of what's going on inside of you. And you wonder about that. You might tremble about that. That's sort of like death, to not be in control of the relationships and people and events in my life. And we scramble. As long as we believe we need to be in control, you and I will have fear. It's a cause and effect. The more we think we need to be in control and we're not, the greater the fear. The more that we're surrendered to God for the most important things in our life, the less the fear. But fear, I mentioned, is a cruel taskmaster, because on one hand, what we say is, I don't want to be out of control. But on the other hand, we say, I need to be in control. And once we say, I need to be in control, the inevitable question that comes, or the next thing that comes, is pressure. Because now I'm on duty. I've got to make sure that I'm working with the people in my life to get them to do what they ought to do and to respond how they ought to respond and to get my world like I think it ought to be. Pressure. The greater the sense that I have to be in control, the greater the fear. So whether I'm out of control or whether I have tried to go for lots of control, either way, as long as I have the value of control, whether I have it or don't have it, I'm going to fear. The antidote here is surrender to God. Now, the third aspect of that fear is it's driven deeper by a quest for answers. A quest for answers, for explanations, for understanding. What I think about here is the difference between I want to live in a world that's predictable and the world that God has me in is filled with mystery. And as long as I believe that the world needs to be predictable, it needs to be under some semblance of control, the more I set myself up for fear. The more I'm willing to embrace mystery, to let God be God, to surrender to Him, that is the great antidote to fear. Let's look at this in Job 28. Where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? What Job has been asking throughout these chapters is, God, why are you allowing me to go through this suffering? What did I do to deserve this? I want some answers. I want some explanations. Give me some understanding. If I just had understanding, some reasons, some explanations, then this might be tolerable. Where does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? Verse 21. It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing. It's a hard thing for us to swallow, isn't it? God never told Job why he put him through this suffering. Apparently, from God's point of view, answers or reasons or explanations, I think, would not only have not helped Job, but would have made his plight worse. So God said, no. It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds of the air. And then, two things are personified as if they're people and they're talking. Destruction and death. And these two creatures say, only a rumor of it, understanding, has reached our ears. Even these two creatures that have been around for centuries and millennia, they ain't got a clue. I don't get this either. I don't understand this either. Only a rumor of it has reached our ears. Verse 23, God understands the way to it, and He alone knows where it dwells. Is that enough for you? Is that enough for me? Most of the time it's not. And that produces fear. For He views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. Only He's got the panoramic view of life, my past, my future, my destiny. I certainly don't. I have a very small picture of my past, a fading picture of my past as age keeps its plight upon me. And I don't know really what's going to happen tomorrow. But God does. He sees everything under the heavens. When He established the force of the wind, measured out the waters. When He made a decree for the rain and the path for the thunderstorm. These are all easy things for God to arrange. He's in control, a certain amount of mystery. Then He looked at wisdom as God's creating everything. God looked at wisdom and appraised it. you know, like a house you want to buy. Go get an appraisal. You can take a look at that. I want to take a look and see, is there mold in the house? Is there a leaky pipe somewhere? Are there things that need to be fixed? I looked at wisdom and appraised it. He looked at wisdom. He confirmed it and tested it. And he said to man, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. Now, the fear of the Lord, if you want a simple understanding of that, is what we call surrender. It's enough to surrender to the sovereignty of God. That should settle something in my heart. That should give me peace instead of fear. What God points to is not answers or reasons or explanations. He points to surrender. And then the second thing, and to shun evil, is understanding. And here, understanding is different than how we think of understanding as answers or explanations. Here, an understanding means an understanding of life that says, what is my duty? How do I respond to this today? That's the summary of what he sees at this particular point of view. It's not reasons, it's not explanations. Number four, suffering jars our sense of control and thrusts us to peace only God can provide. Suffering jars our sense of control and thrusts us to peace only God can provide. Now, if you've read the book of Job, God speaks in chapter 1 and chapter 2. And then from chapter 3 through 37, God is silent. And you have Job and three of his friends and one of Job's counselor who do all the speaking. And they go on and on and on. And Job wants a hearing with God. And he wants, you know, God, you got some answers to do. I wish I could be in a courtroom. I want to state my case before you. What you're doing is not fair and it's not right. And God hasn't spoken for all these chapters. Finally, in Job chapter 38 through 41, God speaks. And what we would normally think of is that the way God is going to speak is he's going to speak with sensitivity. He's going to be politically correct. He's going to look at Job and all the pain that he's had, and he's going to speak mildly. Instead, God looks at something else. He looks not at his pain, but at his pride. And instead of speaking mildly, God speaks wildly, almost like with a sledgehammer. It's hard to read for most of us the first time you read this, because you think, man, how could God be this insensitive to his pain? What God sees is that there's something deeper that's causing Job immense more pain, that unless that rock of granite is broken, he's going to continue to be one miserable human being. Chapter 38, verse 1. The Lord answered Job out of the storm. Now, what we'd expect to hear is something like this. Finally, God speaks. It was a sunny day. The birds were chirping in the sky. There was a soft wind and a soft breeze. The clouds were wafting overhead. And Job had a splendid time with God in the Word, and God spoke to him. That is not how these next five chapters read. They read like God is pulling out a sledgehammer and he is going to work on a condemned building that needs to be destroyed and something built in its place. He speaks out of the storm. In other words, this is, it's hard for us in Southern California to catch this, but if you live in almost anywhere else, thunder and lightning bolts and just awful wind and wind that's or storm or rain that's driven. And you just don't go outside for a day or two. The dogs are barking because they're so scared of this. That's the picture out of which God speaks. Now, that's different than hearing from God on a nice, pleasant day when you've got your cup of coffee and you see the sunrise. God speaks out of the storm. What does he say? His first question is a rhetorical question. Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Now, that may seem like a harsh statement, but he's sort of saying something like this. What kind of idiot are you? It's sort of my version of this. You have got to be kidding. Do you understand so little of who I am and so little of who you are? This is a problem that needs to change. Verse 3. He says, brace yourself like a man. In other words, you better buckle your seatbelt up. We're flying at 38,000 feet, but we may be flying at 28,000 feet in just a few seconds. You're going to be glad if you got your seatbelt on. I will question you, you shall answer me. Now, what God is putting his finger on is this. Job, you have put yourself unwittingly in my throne, in my throne room, sitting on my throne. And the way you live your life is acting as if I'm one of your vassals, one of your servants. That it's your job is to, my job is to do your bidding and make life be like you. And you've got this completely backwards. And unless this changes, you'll never discover the wonder of who I am. Not a chance. You will be one angry person at me. And then he begins to ask him a series of many questions. And each of these questions are meant to be like a sledgehammer against granite. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone? Now, I had a little taste of this, something like this, when I was in third grade. I was one chatterbox in third grade. I drove Mrs. Pfister nuts when I was in third grade. I was talking to my friends all the time. She continually had to correct me, put me in the back of the room, sit me out in the hallway, send me to the principal's office. I mean, this poor Mrs. Pfister tried everything. And then it was a week of report cards. And I knew my mother and father were pretty strict on this. Whatever I get, I'm going to be answering for, not just to the school, but to them. And the school wasn't all that important. What mattered was answering to them. And I went up and asked Mrs. Pfister about, they used to give a grade for conduct. And I was doing pretty good in everything except conduct, I thought. So I went up to Mrs. Pfister on Tuesday before the Friday. I said, Mrs. Pfister, do you know what grade you're going to give me for conduct? She said, yeah. I said, well, what is it? She says, you're going to get an F. Now, I knew that when my mother saw that F, it was not going to be pretty. And when my dad got home, it was going to be even uglier. And so on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, I was a model student, sitting at my desk, listening to the teacher, answering questions, volunteering to read something, going to the board to write. And on Friday afternoon, she handed out the report cards. I opened up my report card out of the little manila folder, and I had A's and B's and almost ran. I looked at it, conduct F. I thought, oh, I am in so much trouble when I get home. So the bell rang, everybody got up, and I took my report card, and I went up to Mrs. Pfister. I said, Mrs. Pfister, you gave me an F in conduct. And she said, yes, I did, Seth. I said, well, the last 3 days, wasn't I really good? And she said, well, yes, but it was the other 47 that got you in trouble. That's sort of what Job, on a much grander and deeper scale, is realizing as he's listening to this. Now, what I think of is something like this. What's that granite that God is pounding away at, that he also pounds away at in you and me? It's things like, I must be in control. Life must be predictable as I count it predictable. How I define life and fulfillment must be to my specifications. And number four, I must be able to understand what you're doing with my life. Now, all those things are part of our old nature. And none of those things just fly out the door when we become Christians. God has to take his hammer, sometimes a sledgehammer, and power away at us. But the chapters 38 to 41 aren't all just about God's power and a sledgehammer. There's also an invitation, and it's tucked away in verse 7 of chapter 38. As God is recounting the creation story and all the details that he made with his power, there are also plenty of pictures in here of just God's delight and a sense of wonder and beauty about this. And one little excerpt, while the morning stars sang together. Now, the stars didn't actually sing together, But what he's describing is a universe that looked at what was being created and was just so just caught up with joy, it could hardly contain itself. Who would have thought of creating something as wondrous as this? And then second picture, and all the angels shouted for joy. Now, what God is saying is, it's not just about my power, but it's about my heart. There's something deeper than just my power, and that's my heart. It's not just, Job, it's not just that you can trust me because I am powerful, but what you're called to do instead of control is to trust my heart. That's closer to here than anything we've seen in the book of Job. And then on the back of your hand at number 5, fear. Becoming free from the need of blessings because God is our greatest treasure. Part of what God is trying to do in your life and my life is what you might think of as detachment and attachment. He is working to detach us, think of Velcro, from our addiction and our need for these things here. He's trying to detach our hearts from having to need these and that this is what's life. And he's trying to attach different parts of our heart to the treasure. What only he can add to who we are. None of us really likes lemonade on the surface. There are other things we prefer. This is not going to be to sound very good to us as long as we think that what's over here is chocolate milkshakes. I prefer chocolate milkshakes. I prefer my son's salted caramel ice cream. I prefer chocolate chip cookies. I prefer coffee. There are a lot of things I prefer to life. It's not until I'm in a desert where these things aren't working that the idea of lemonade becomes, huh, you know, I'm thirstier than I thought I was. And I start to move in this direction and begin to ponder, what's in here? I wonder if I was made for lemonade. There's an idea. Now, at the end of chapter 41 ends and Job replies. Verse 1. Verse 2, I know that you can do all things. In other words, he's saying, I thought I was in control, not in control. You're in control. No plan of yours can be thwarted. No plan of yours. A plan of mine can certainly be thwarted. But God's plan for me cannot be thwarted. Though I'd like for it to end up a certain way and play out a certain way and have certain results, my story is not really my story. I'm a player in God's story. And however God wants to use me in his story with the people in my life is up to him. The role that he gives me to play is up to him. The script he hands to me is up to him. This is the specific side of surrendering to him. Verse 3. Job says, you asked me, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? That was the first question. Surely, Job says, I spoke of things I did not understand. Certainly true. But then notice what else he sees. Things too wonderful for me to know. That's the heart part of God. That's the delightful part of God. It's not just about God's wisdom and power, but his heart and delight. You said to me, listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me. And Job's response in verse 5 is, my ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Meaning, I once had the theological understanding of you, but now I've tasted pink lemonade. And I think I get it. Life is over here. It's not over there. When those things happen, it's delightful. It's wonderful. I like it when desires are met, but what I need is right here. And if I don't pursue this, I'm going to pursue this over here, and I'm going to make a mess of things. And verse 6, therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. This is not a call to a low self-esteem, to despise myself. Woe is me, what's wrong with me? It's a call to say, I'm a mess. Everything about me was wrapped in arrogance and pride and sitting in the throne room of God and in his chair and having him answer to me. And I realize I will never experience lemonade, pink lemonade, as long as I am maintained the way I am. It takes a sledgehammer to get me to where God wants me to be. When I think about verse 6, I think about something like this. We would look at this as sort of pride pride crushing, and over here it's treasure discovering. Much of what drives God's work in your life and my life is this very thing. A crushing, a necessary crushing of pride, and a delightful opening of the door to treasure what we were made for. How about you? Control? Predictability? High things for you? High values? Fear? Trying to tamp that thing down? Is that, you find yourself living life there? What Job calls us to is a life of surrender. Surrender to God, to let God be God in our lives, and to seek Him as our first thing treasure. First thing pleasure. There was an elderly man that was at the doctor's office, and he was terminal. And he went to his doctor, and he said, when they're finishing up their appointment, he said, "Doc, I'm afraid to die." He said, "What's on the other side?" The doctor said, "Well, you know, we don't have really clear picture of what is there." And the man was stunned by that because he said, "Well, you're a Christian, aren't you?" And the doctor said, "Yes." "You say we don't really know with clarity what's on the other side?" He said, "Well, we know some things of what's on the other side. We don't know everything." And the man was puzzling over this, and right about that time, the two of them heard the scratching at the bottom of the door and this little whining and saw a little paw trying to stick out beneath the door. And the doctor reached over and opened the door, and in bounded the doctor's dog. And the dog saw his master and leaped up into the air, and the doctor caught him. And the doctor turned to the elderly man and he said, "My dog has never been in this room before." He had no idea what was in this room. The table, pictures, equipment. The only thing he knew was that his master was in this room. And that's all he needed. Let's pray together. Father, if we're aware of our hearts, we're aware of a lot of anxiety and worry and fear that goes on that we live with, and we try to tamp it down rather than to ask you, what's going on inside of me? What do I think I really need to make life work? And to particularly expose my self-centeredness, my commitment to myself, to being in control and life is predictable and not having to trust you. I don't want to trust you. I want to trust me. And all of that needs to be exposed as folly. And it creates all kinds of messes in me and with others. Would you help us to face ourselves? Help us to see these lights on the dashboard that go off and to that should propel us to you in deeper ways, to ask deeper questions.